Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Wild horses on their bended knees will not get them to vote for Rishi Sunak.
I want the modern, secure borders which can sustainably protect this country from what I think is a national security emergency.
Is Starmer's support deep enough and wide enough to maintain these huge opinion poll leads as and when Labour roll out policies?
Seeking to control migration and secure your borders is not a right-wing opinion. It is a mainstream opinion.
One. We have liftoff.
Welcome once again to Planet Normal, the Telegraph podcast with Alison Pearson.
Hello.
And me, Liam Halligan. Tory meltdown continues co-pilot as two more ministers quit Sunak's government. Harlow MP Robert Alfin stood down as Education Minister, while James Heapy, who represents Wells in Somerset, has resigned as Armed Forces Minister. Both MPs have said they won't contest the next general election, which brings the running total of Tories quitting the House of Commons to 63. That's rapidly approaching 75, the highest number of Conservative MPs voluntarily to leave Parliament, which we saw ahead of Labour's landslide in 1997. But as local elections approach in England and Wales on May the 2nd, plus mayoral elections in England on the same day, including the high-profile contest for London Mayor, a debate that we've had on Planet Normal in recent months, should the Tories roll the dice and change leaders again, is now gathering pace in the Commons. Meanwhile, a poll in the Telegraph suggests 95% of private schools will increase fees should a Labour government go through with plans to add 20% VAT to the cost of independent education, the subject of your latest Telegraph column, Alison. Link in the show notes to this episode. And Abdulazidi has been granted a Muslim funeral and burial. The 35-year-old Afghan was previously given asylum despite multiple sex offences and being rejected twice after arriving in the UK illegally in 2016. Azidi convinced a head-in-the-clouds reverend he was a committed Christian, a fact that the judge who granted him asylum admitted had weighed heavily on this decision, even though Azidi failed the Home Office's standard Christianity test. In January, of course, Azidi committed a horrific chemical attack on a woman and her two young children in Clapham, South London. He was later pulled dead from the Thames. And we've learned this week that Azidi was given a funeral at a mosque in West London and a Muslim burial at a cemetery in East London, making a mockery of his so-called Christian conversion. Lots more to talk about co-pilot. Satisfaction with the NHS has plummeted to a record low of just 24% last year amid intense public frustration with long waits for care, according to the local social attitudes survey. That's down from 70% satisfaction in 2010. But amidst all these serious affairs of state, Alison, you've also written this week about an issue close to your heart. Members of the all-male Garrick Club in central London have been relinquishing said membership. And that's got your goat.
Before we get into the goings-on at the Garrick, Liam, I had an idea. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
I thought we could have a weekly...
No. I don't agree.
I thought we could start a weekly feature called Tory Implosion Corner. We've got to make our own fun, co-pilot. What do you think? TIC. The most devastating stat of the week for the government. Anyway, we're going to come to that. Yeah, I was quite upset by this stuff at the Garrick Club, founded in 1831. And the fun sponges at The Guardian have decided that it's not fair that this bastion of male elitism doesn't admit women members. It hasn't admitted women members for quite some time, but about every 4 or 5 years, a few people come out and start saying how disgraceful this is. And of course, we saw the head of the civil service, Simon Case, MI6 chief Richard Moore. Four judges have resigned their membership of the Garrick this week in hasty embarrassment, lest they fall foul of the woke mob. You know, Liam, I am a feminist. I want to see full equality for my sex, but this is not a hill I wouldn't even choose to stumble on this hill, let alone die on it. And I think it's just spiteful. I think it's a way of all this sort of cancel culture. It's about removing the colour and the fun and the eccentricity from life. Women enjoy being in all female company, you know, women in their own book groups and the WI and so on. And men, as you will testify, co-pilot, enjoy being in male company. No one has suggested the WI should start admitting blokes for, you know, icing buns and crochet lessons. I just think it's sort of mean, really. And I just think you've got this fashion entrepreneur, Emily Bendel, who is organising this petition demanding that the ridiculously outdated rule at the Garrick be cancelled. But I don't think people like this Emily Bendel woman, she doesn't want to join the Garrick. I mean, I've been there. I went years ago for lunch with Clive James, and it was sweet. It was absolutely charming, you know, very, very oldie worldy, lovely. Why do we have to destroy everything like that in our country? You know, are we all going to be, you know, in some sort of marvellous human resources world where no one will say boo to a goose and there's no sort of madness or whatever colour? I deplore it, Halligan.
I think it is, as you say, spiteful, Alison. It's spiteful to say that there can't be all male spaces, just like it's spiteful and dangerous, physically dangerous, to say that there can't be all female spaces. And I think this is particularly mean of The Guardian, particularly hypocritical. Plenty of former Guardian editors, distinguished Guardian journalists, have been member of the Garrick.
Yeah.
Plenty of BBC journalists are member of the Garrick. I see them there all the time. I'm not a member, but I've got a couple of friends who are. I go there sometimes. There are often women there, but sometimes there aren't. That's the point. It's a place where women can come as guests. But I think the benefits of an all-male space are useful, and the benefits of all-female spaces are both useful and physically important. And I do think it's just childish to try and shame people from not being members of an all-male club. I find it really, really infantile, actually.
It's also the not insignificant matter of the menus. So the last time I was in a men's club, which wasn't not the Garrick, not that long ago, and there's literally nothing I could find as a female to eat on the menu. I mean, the chump chops was the nearest to anything I would begin to have for lunch. And as I said, it rapidly descended to intestines and offal. I mean, it's total school food, Liam, isn't it? I mean, it's just leave men to it, say I. We want to go to places where there's salad and vegetables, you know, not stuff wrapped in salad cream. I mean, it really is back to 1957 in most of those places, isn't it?
It certainly is. So what do you make of recent events? Halfen's resigned, a very respected minister. Hebe's resigned, equally very respected. Do you think your argument for the Tories to have another leadership election before a general election is strengthened or weakened over the last week? He asks, knowing the answer.
Well, we were going to keep this secret from you, but Isabel Bujar, Cass Ho and I are picking out a very large hat for you to eat. Because you said they won't fall below 100 seats.
No, look, you keep saying up these straw men. I did not say that. You will never hear me having said that. So I don't mind, you know, a bit of light ribbing, but untruths. I did not say that.
All right.
They could easily fall below 100 seats. Of course they could. The question is, and we'll never know the answer because we'll never know the counterfactual, would having a leadership change now mean that they win more seats than they otherwise would have done under Sunak? And while Sunak is deeply imperfect, I reckon the psychodrama of changing leader again now, the international outrage that would generate, the, you know, what the gilts market would do, what most people who don't follow politics very closely would think, I just think it would be a disaster. It could be an extinction event from the Tories. Now, it doesn't mean that they might not do it, because as we've discussed many times, and you've made the point forcefully, and I agree, you know, the 2nd of May could be a disaster for them. And it may be that, you know, certain people on the Tory backbenches think if we can get 15% of the parliamentary party to submit letters to Sir Graham Brady, then we're going to have a leadership change. And it could be done quickly with online voting. Absolutely. But what would
swing voters across the country think? I think they would feel the Tories have gone completely mad.
It's not about swing voters. It's about summoning back the Tories who voted for Boris in 2019. It's about persuading. I know I keep saying this in each by-election. In the last 2 years, we have seen a considerable percentage of the Conservative vote refuse to vote at all. So I think that a Kemi or a Suella or even a Jenrick, possibly a Priti, I think that my lot, my Telegraph lot, the only way they could be persuaded to vote Conservative at all now and not vote for reform or not vote for no one, which is where many of them are, is with a change of leader. They wild horses on their bended knees will not get them to vote for Rishi Sunak. So it is not about capturing any of the people who would vote Lib Dem. It would purely be making a conservative appeal to conservatives. Now I am hearing, Liam, that many, many conservative MPs, as you say, we know 63, have said they're standing down, getting to the head of the dole queue, as somebody joked this week. I've heard of a lot of them are now making inquiries about jobs. So I think a lot of them think it's all over. I think it's all over. And what remains to be decided is how many will cling on. And we are literally now in a situation where cabinet ministers with majorities of 20,000 plus could be facing their own Portillo moment, which many listeners will recall was the Enfield Southgate seat, which was held, occupied rather admirably, actually, by Michael Portillo. And I think he was still Minister for Defence. You'll correct me, co-pilot, if I'm wrong, but he was brutally unseated in the 1997 election. Now, was it Stephen Twigg?
It was indeed Stephen Twigg.
Yeah.
And also the young Lib Dem was Jeremy Brown. And there's an amazing book, Were You Still Up for Portillo, about the 1997 general election, a book by the brilliant journalist Brian Cathcart. And he's got a fantastic picture of Michael Portillo trying to deal with the fact that he'd just been drummed out of parliament, and a smiling, cackling Stephen Twigg, who rightly was enjoying his victory because he was the poster child of New Labour at that point. And it has led to this, as you say, this phrase in politics, a Portillo moment, where a really big beast gets absolutely whacked by the electorate. And there could be plenty of those. I mean, even big beasts like Robert Halfen, and he is a big beast. We know the Harlow constituency well, don't we? We both live quite near there. And why is Halfen leaving? You know, he's only 55. He's full of energy. He's got a 14,000 majority. Heapy's got a 10,000 majority. And both those seats could indeed be in danger. Certainly Scott Benson, who has caused a by-election, which will probably be on May the 2nd as well, in Blackpool South, after he was suspended from his own party on misdemeanours, shall we say. He denies all wrongdoing. He's got a majority of less than 4,000 in Blackpool South. So that's probably going to go down as well. And you're right, a lot of these Tories are now looking for new jobs. There's going to be a glut of Tory MPs hitting the jobs market, ex-Tory MPs. The question is Starmer's support deep enough and wide enough to maintain these huge opinion poll leads, 20-25% plus in the polls, as and when Labour roll out their policies and the left gets increasingly irate, the left of the Labour Party, that the policies are far too pedestrian, far too unradical. And so, you know, Labour could have difficulties in the run-up to the election. But I think the way things currently stand, leadership change or not leadership change, the Tories are clearly, they're cruising for a bruising, as we say.
I don't think it's much to do with the Labour vote. I still think there will be a historic low turnout. We're not faced with neither party. It's exciting, barely any enthusiasm. I think this will be an election where the Conservative government pays the price of not being Conservative. I think people are absolutely devastated, and lots of my lot, and I take a great barometer, I would say, particularly male readers of the Telegraph are overwhelmingly now switching to reform. And I expect the gap to close between the Conservatives and Reform. And if they get to 15 and the Conservatives are on 17, then this shall we ditch the leader thing might change. Before we move on, Liam, can I just say I think Robert Halfen has been a fantastic MP.
Absolutely.
Really lovely guy, famous for fighting for the motorist. I mean, keeping fuel duty down. And during lockdown, particularly, it was when I noticed him and met him. And he was a great campaigner for children, for trying to keep schools open. Robert has a disability himself. He's been a passionate advocate for the disabled and a great fighter for school children. And I think he is a huge loss, actually. And I think it's incredibly sad that the part of this great shift in Conservative fortunes will see good people like Robert Halfen lost.
I couldn't agree more. I think he's been an exemplary parliamentarian since 2010. He hasn't been ideological. I mean, you had Labour MPs on Twitter saying how sad they were that Robert Halfen was standing down, saying how decent he was as a minister, as an MP. It's just a shame that people of his calibre, people who are as deep-rooted in their constituency as he is, feel that they need to leave Parliament. I'm sure he has his reasons, and whatever they are, I respect them because he's been a great public servant. He is the embodiment of the response to those who say all politicians are in it for themselves. I don't think that he is. I think that he's genuinely a decent man. And James Heapy too. These are highly credible Conservative MPs, respected across the House, respected in their constituencies and beyond. Big losses now for Rishi Sunak.
One Labour policy we do know about, in fact, I think it's almost the only Labour policy we've heard of so far, is this slapping 20% VAT on school fees. Now, this is really kicking off Copilot, isn't it? Because this week it's been predicted to cause a stampede of children coming out of the independent sector towards grammar schools like the one that a certain Keir Starmer attended in Reigate, not the first or the last of the Labour Party to benefit from the selective education that they like to ban for everybody else's children. But I did, as you mentioned at the top, Liam, I wrote about this week, and I have to say we've had thousands and thousands of responses to this. It's an extraordinary hot topic. And I think this policy is vengeful. It's class war. It's actually stupid. It's deeply harmful to thousands of kids, but particularly, I would say, special needs children. Now, I know friends who have got children with dyslexia, profound dyslexia and disabilities, who have obtained partly funded, council funded places in private schools. And that's been immensely beneficial for helping them to function and thrive in education. And so this class war policy, these private schools, it's not all Eton and Westminster, it's not all super rich people, often people who've made huge sacrifices to just about be able to afford their children to be in one of these schools. So this is all about Starmer chucking some red meat at the sort of ravening class warriors on his party's left. And I think that there are 164 grammar schools left in this country. Here on Planet Normal, we are big fans, Liam, aren't we? Both of us coming from homes where a grammar school would have been very useful. My parents went to grammar school. I believe your mum went to grammar school.
She did.
There is now going to be an arms race in tutoring of these children from the independent sector, because they'll all want to get a grammar school place. So the children from the more modest homes for whom a grammar school place would have been a sort of golden Willy Wonka, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory ticket, that's going to be snatched away from them by children whose parents can afford to pay thousands of pounds a year to private tutors.
I think this is a very divisive red meat policy for Labour to throw to their left wing in order to keep them stum in the run-up to an election. I should say I'm a governor of two independent schools. Nothing I'm saying here reflects meetings I've had at those schools. But it is clear, if you look at a lot of studies that have been done across the education industry, that there is a sense that Labour's claim that they're going to make £1.6 billion from this policy is completely nuts, because a lot of parents just aren't going to be able to afford you know, 20% extra on fees. It won't necessarily be the full 20% because schools can offset some of the VAT on their spending. But it's not just VAT, Alison, it's business rates as well. Schools' exemption from business rates is going to be ended as well. And that could be even worse financially.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, for a lot of schools with big estates and so on. And it will be, you know, the bursaries that get thrown by the wayside. That would be the first thing that schools cut, the money that they spend collaborating with local state schools. It will be, as you say, an arms race because a lot of sharp-elbowed parents who won't be able to afford the school fees at independent schools will come into the state sector. They'll move into houses right next to the best state schools.
Yeah.
Their kids will be tutored to within an inch of their lives for the 11 plus, where our 160 or so grammar schools are still relevant, those parts of the country. So I was in at the Labour conference back in the autumn. I was in the hall. Obviously, they're covering it as a journalist for the Keir Starmer's speech. And you know, when he said various things, you know, he'd get a clap and all the rest of it. But when he said he was going to scrap VAT relief on independent education, it wasn't just a clap and a cheer. It was a visceral pitchfork scream from the Labour Party faithful, many of whom, of course, will have been to independent schools, many of whom will be, you know, trustafarians living on their family's money. Not all of them, and not even most of them, but quite a lot of them. There is, as you say, a real hypocrisy here with Labour MPs who have benefited from independent education, like I did, winning a scholarship aged 10 to an independent school, changed my life. They want to pull up the drawbridge. I don't want to pull up the drawbridge. I think there's a role for independent education. And I think that this Labour policy is regressive. It will harm the poor most. And it will probably cost the Exchequer money rather than raising money for the Exchequer, given the extra pressure it's going to put on already, in some cases, overcrowded state schools as people flee from the independent sector because the parents aren't wealthy. You know, they can only sacrifice their holiday and, you know, drive an old car. These families in the cost of living crisis are, you know, they are literally making ends meet by working all hours. And it's just deeply, deeply spiteful, I think, for Labour to do this.
Later on, we've got so many emails. I mean, we could fill the entire programme with emails from people whose parents worked round the clock cleaning. One lady said her mum was counting the money for SecuraCorps, working three jobs just to get them into a school that gave them a good start. And they've all gone on to be higher rate taxpayers, hugely successful. One listener said, I've paid millions in income tax because my parents were prepared to make those sacrifices. And there is also, I'm not sure if the private schools go to the war, Liam, how many Olympians we're going to have, because pretty much some of the most top flight athletes, oarsmen particularly, netball players, hockey players, all those people, we're happy to cheer, aren't we, when there's a big international sporting occasion, rugby players and so on, some of the great, in fact, JPR Williams, one of my heroes, amazing Welsh rugby player, Sir Gareth Edwards, both lucky enough to be picked from Wales and to go to Millfield School. That Millfield is a great private school for some of our best athletes and sports people. So talk about strangling the golden goose. I do think that Britain excels at private education. It's a fantastic export for us, provides a matchless education for many of our kids, particularly the ones who go into science and technology, and will certainly be the poorer if that's snatched away. Something that caught my eye, Liam, which I think is actually really significant, and actually, although it sounds like bad news, I think is conversely is good news. So there's a British Attitude survey this week, which recorded record dissatisfaction with the National Health Service. Now, only 24% of patients said they were at all satisfied with the NHS last year, and that is down drastically from 70% in 2010.
Unreal.
Unreal. But actually, something I've been thinking for a long time, because, you know, we get a tremendous mailbag from listeners, Telegraph readers, telling barely conceivable tales of delay, neglect, suffering. We've had Planet Normal GP, Dr. Claire, who writes now that she is ashamed to be an NHS GP. That has become a service. She wrote to us last week, Liam, it's become a service purely for managers, not for patients. So I think the fact that this satisfaction with the NHS is the lowest since records began is a really amazing sign now that the mythology of our NHS, that familiar RNHS, which has been so hostile to the idea of any reform, it's people have absolutely refused to have any criticism of it. There's a big Michael Sheen play at the National at the moment about the foundation of the NHS. I mean, literally, you know, you'd swear it was the birth of Jesus Christ. And yet this thing has now, I think, become a national disgrace. Thousands of excess deaths, which I believe are linked directly to these giant hospital waiting lists and the official level of denial about it, politicians refusing to talk about it, chuck them another, you know, few billion. It's £165 billion a year the NHS costs us, and barely third world service now for the British people. So I hope, I don't know what you think, I hope that this will now make politicians think, hang on, these people are really, really fed up with this.
I think that's right. The official waiting list is 7.7 million. We've established on Planet Normal, listening to NHS insiders, not only those, but also Planet Normal listeners with experience at the sharp end, that there are waiting lists for the waiting lists.
There are.
That's why I said 9 million at the top, which yeah. I think is a small C conservative estimate,
yeah.
if I may say so. This can't be dismissed as some kind of ideological poll, Alison. This is the British Social Attitude Survey,
yeah.
one of the most respected statistical exercises literally on the planet. It's mimicked around the world, I can tell you that. And also what's interesting from that Social Attitude Survey, when asked about government choices on tax and spending related to the NHS, while all we hear on television chat shows is, oh, of course, it's all money, we need more money, we need more money, we need more money. While 48% do back increasing taxes and spending more on the NHS, 42% want to keep taxes and spending the same and think it's all about reform. And that's before we've really had a debate about that. You and I know from our own writing and responses to it, you're almost pilloried if you say it isn't about the money. It's about how you organize it. It's about the system that we have. It's about looking at the best that we can learn from on the continent. And, you know, it isn't just a choice between stripped back American healthcare and, you know, a massively statist system like the NHS, employing 1.4 million people or whoever it is. There are many countries on the continent who combine free at the point of use healthcare, which I will always defend, and I know you will, with not this massive state monolith and massive, massive inefficiencies. We have some of the worst outcomes in the OECD, as we've often said on Planet Normal,
yeah.
with evidence for the big three, strokes, oncology, and heart attacks. We're right down the bottom of the OECD league table. We are by no means the best in the world, and it's just jingoistic nonsense to say that we are when it comes to our health system.
I think we were very good at death, though, Liam, weren't we? What was the thing we were very good at? I can't remember. It was something hilarious, wasn't it? The one thing where we weren't bottom was there was some amazing. What was it? Remember, we had that lovely guy on, and he said basically
we had Tim Knox on from Civitas.
There was one thing where we were tremendous at death, absolutely second to last most miserable people on the planet, and absolutely top notch at death. Can we just end actually this section with a Velma stat, because we haven't had a Velma stat for a while, have we?
No, Scooby Doo. Oh, that's an Alison Scooby. That's rare.
That is. I'm not as good.
How many Alison Scoobies have we had in our near 200 episodes?
Maybe like three.
Just a handful.
I'm a bit
just
nervous.
A pawful, a little pawful.
A pawful. Yeah, Velma stat. Listen to this with your economist brain. 48% of the NHS's budget of over £165 billion is spent on back office and management. Don't worry about the patients. Don't worry, they're fine.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Our guest on Planet Normal this week has been making headlines with his trenchant criticism of government policy on immigration. He knows whereof he speaks. Robert Jenrick served as Minister of State for Immigration from 2022 to last December, when he resigned over Rishi Sunak's Rwanda bill, saying that it did not go far enough. Before quitting, Jenrick did manage to persuade Rishi Sunak to announce a package which would reduce legal immigration from its unsustainable level of 745,000. Robert Jenrick was born in Wolverhampton, where he attended the local grammar school, going on to read history at Cambridge. In 2014, Jenrick became the MP for Newark. By 2019, he was the youngest member of Boris Johnson's cabinet, serving as Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government. Threats to community cohesion posed by too much immigration soon became a generic theme. When he became immigration minister, he caused controversy with his tough stance, saying things like, "We must not elevate the well-being of illegal migrants above those of the British people." In April 2023, defending the government's illegal migration bill, he said that refugees crossing the English Channel, quotes, cannibalise communities by importing different lifestyles and values, and that the nation has a right to preserve itself. Whilst it's impossible to determine the exact numbers, Jenrick said, the basic fact is undeniable. The vast number of people who are willing and able to reach the UK today is astronomical and vastly outnumbers what we are capable or willing to take as a country. Previously, Robert Jenrick was known as a close Rishi Sunak loyalist. More recently, we have seen him move rightwards, becoming a thorn in his government's side. Robert Jenrick, a very warm welcome aboard the Rocket of Right Thinking. An exciting fact I have learned, Robert, is that your mum is a Planet Normal fan.
She loved listening to your podcast, Alison. So she'll be doing her ironing listening to this, you can bet.
Well, fantastic, Mrs. Jenrick. Robert, we've just seen a review by Dame Sarah Khan, the PM's advisor for social cohesion, saying that a climate of harassment and censorship threatens our democratic way of life. Now, she cites the religious studies teacher at Batley Grammar School, who in March 2021 was forced into hiding with his family after he showed a cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad during a lesson. The poor man is still hiding from a hateful mob. Robert, what should the Conservative government's response have been to that teacher who was cleared of any malicious intent by an independent investigation?
Well, I appointed Sarah Khan when I was Community Secretary, and I've been concerned about this for a very long time. And one of the motivations was that terrible incident in Batley, where I felt that the school, the council, and frankly, the government let down this individual who is still in hiding, still concerned for his safety. Although that incident was a particularly severe one, it was in no sense an isolated case. There are hundreds of incidents of people being bullied, having to change their views, their jobs, their homes, because of extremists in our community. And that has to change. We have to tackle this as a country. And I think since the time I appointed her a few years back, this situation has only got worse. We're now at a new shameful high watermark as a result of the explosion of hate that we've seen since October the 7th. And We have to not just tackle the symptoms of it, supporting the victims, we have to tackle the causes. And that is not just tinkering, but it's having a systemic change in our country to say that we cannot allow this to continue. It is not right that the police are adopting the approach that they are. I want to see robust enforcement of our existing laws. You know, you cannot live in a country where people can project genocidal chants on the side of a Big Ben or cry jihad off Oxford Street, and that is in any sense tolerated by our police. And then lastly, we have to accept the reality that there are simply too many people coming into our country every year, perfectly legally. You know, 1.2 million people gross is just too many, and it's impossible to successfully integrate people in the manner that Sara Khan seeks if that number of people is coming in every year. And that is one of the things that I had made core to the political agenda that I'm pursuing, trying to persuade the government and make the argument in the country that we need a fundamentally different approach to legal migration.
During the Rochdale by-election, we saw disturbing scenes in Parliament, didn't we, with the Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, changing the manner of business to accommodate possible threats to certain MPs. What a really notorious episode, I think. Robert, do you think that sensitivity about cultural cohesion, not stirring up a hornet's nest in certain Muslim communities, has made politicians too scared to stand up for the values of a free society?
I do. And like you, I thought that was a dark day for democracy. The idea that a Speaker of the House of Commons should change the proceedings of our Parliament, supposedly because he was concerned for the safety and well-being of members of Parliament, is deeply troubling. We should be taking a stand. And I do think that there are far too few members of Parliament who are willing to speak openly about these issues for fear, perhaps, of personal safety, perhaps for fear of being labelled as racists. And they are shirking a very serious debate that we need to have about extremism of all kinds. But the evidence suggests that the greatest threat today is from Islamist extremism. And we need to have the confidence and courage to say that, because that is simply where the evidence takes us. And to have a broader debate about multiculturalism and how we build a cohesive and well-integrated society. And unfortunately, I think multiculturalism has failed, and we need to take action to try to correct that. And if politicians are not willing to say that and instead have a pretend debate about being nice to each other or discourse on social media, we will never get to grips with this challenge.
Can the Tories tackle small boats without the UK leaving the ECHR?
Well, I think it's certainly true that the set of treaties and conventions that we signed up to in the years following the Second World War, like the ECHR and the Refugee Convention, are now woefully out of date to meet the challenges that we face today. They were written in a different era when there were millions, not tens or hundreds of millions of people on the move. And I think it is becoming increasingly clear to the British public that our membership of the ECHR is increasingly unsustainable. I don't think it is reformable. I think it's very difficult to see a way forwards. That debate, I think, will now continue and play out. And we have to face up to the challenge that it is an inhibitor on our ability to secure our borders. And the argument that I've made consistently, and in particular since resigning, is that there are a few issues more important than securing your borders. I don't want to see symbolic flights to Rwanda. That's of no particular interest to me. I want the modern, secure borders which can sustainably protect this country from what I think is a national security emergency in an age of mass migration, one that's going to be with us for years, possibly decades to come.
The Lords voted for numerous amendments to the Rwanda bill last week. Now it looks like the bill won't even return to the Commons until after Easter. Yet, as you say, Robert, we are clearly in the middle of a crisis. 3,000 more migrants could have come ashore by the time they start debating it again. How alarming is the situation? And if you were leading the government, what would you do right now?
Given that this is the legislation that the government have pursued, and they described it as emergency legislation the day after I resigned, the fact that it would take 5 months to pursue that legislation, I think shows a fundamental unseriousness. What I think we've got to do is, firstly, I set out in the amendments to the bill at the beginning of the year, the way in which you could do this in a much more robust manner. That means ensuring that people are actually detained on arrival and swiftly removed. It means ending this merry-go-round of individual claims that, unfortunately, the government is allowing to continue. And in fact, they've essentially endorsed my argument by saying that it's going to take 6 to 10 weeks to process those individual claims before they can get the first flight in the air. And I think you've got to ignore these interim measures, so-called Rule 39 injunctions from the Strasbourg court if one comes forward. Offshore processing and removals of the kind that was proposed with Rwanda can work, but it will only create that serious and sustained deterrent if it is done in the most robust way. And that is what all the evidence suggests internationally. The only places that have managed to succeed are those that have taken the most robust measures, and that is what I proposed. Unfortunately, the government has chosen a weaker approach. I hope that they can still change course in the time remaining before the general election.
Before you became immigration minister, to some eyes, you appear to be firmly in the Rishi Sunak centrist camp now, along with Suella Braverman, who left the government over issues around two-tier policing and uncontrolled immigration. You appear to have been radicalised. We're now in the far right, Robert, those of us who consider ourselves to be middle-of-the-road conservatives. I'm curious, what did you find in the Home Office that made you start to really think about this and speak out so forcefully?
Well, firstly, I think seeking to control migration and secure your borders is not a right-wing opinion. It is a mainstream opinion. And you and I and Suella Braverman speak for tens of millions of people, a silent majority of this country. And we shouldn't ever allow ourselves to be portrayed as being on the extremes. Far from it. But you're right that the experience that I had in the Home Office was very formative. I was always interested in this issue as community secretary. I was very concerned about integration, about segregated communities and the failure of multiculturalism. As housing secretary, I came to the conclusion that you could never build your way out of our housing crisis if you were having such high levels of legal migration. But seeing what I did in the Home Office, day in, day out, I was frankly outraged by the lack of grip within government, the sheer numbers of people coming in both legally and illegally, the challenges that both of those separate issues were posing for people in communities right across the country. On legal migration in particular, which in some respect, because of its scale, I think the most important, we were sticking two fingers up to the British public. Members of the public had voted election after election, and certainly in the Brexit referendum, for controlled and limited migration, and yet we were doing precisely the opposite of that. We had made catastrophically bad decisions post-Brexit, which had created a migration system that was even more liberal than the one that we had when we were members of the European Union.
Have we as a country become addicted to mass immigration to keep GDP high, but then having, of course, the ordinary people paying the price for that?
Firstly, Suella is absolutely right in the comments that she said on the Panorama programme. Prime Minister was completely disinterested in this issue. He only discussed it with me when I made clear that this was unsustainable and I would have to leave the government if we didn't resolve. We seem to have become addicted to very high levels of legal migration. 9 years ago, on a manifesto commitment to the tens of thousands, And yet today we have 600,000 or 700,000 people coming into our country. I think the economic model of this country is broken. It is reliant on very large numbers of people coming in from overseas, and that is not working in the best interests of the British public. It's exacerbating the challenge of young people getting on the housing ladder. It's undercutting wages, particularly in certain industries and parts of the country. It's one of the reasons people are struggling to access public services, like GPs and dentists. It is meaning that the pace of change in our country is too fast for too many people. It could be fixed quickly, and there are things that we could do within weeks that would begin to regain the public's trust on this issue.
How low would you like to see it go? Give me a number.
Well, I was elected on a manifesto commitment of tens of thousands. I believe that is eminently deliverable and could be done in a way which doesn't harm either our public services or our economy.
Let's come to the exciting state of the Conservative Party. One of the complaints we hear all the time from Planet Normal listeners and Telegraph readers is that they feel betrayed by their party. Do you understand their frustration, Robert?
I do. I speak to my own constituents in North Nottinghamshire every week. There are many people who are historic Conservative voters who feel frustrated, disillusioned, angry at the state of things, and want to see the party come in with better answers. I think the biggest of those is migration, but also on the economy. You know, we've got to grow the economy. We've got to tackle that with pro-growth reforms, which show people that, you know, we've got answers and authentically conservative answers to the very deep problems that the country is facing.
If recent polls are correct, then Keir Starmer's Labour, for which we've seen in the by-elections, there isn't a vast amount of enthusiasm. Nevertheless, Labour is heading for a landslide victory. We've seen some of your colleagues already announcing they're standing down. I've been told this week that lots of them are shopping about for jobs. They've given up. Can the situation be saved for the Tory party before the election?
Well, evidently the polls are very bad. I believe that there are things that we can do and must do in the time remaining. And if we do that, there is a chance that we can regain the trust of those Conservative voters. Since I resigned from the government, I've tried to make the argument on some of those points. You know, I've argued that we should take much more robust action on illegal migration, that we should cut legal migration, that we should pursue more welfare reforms, that we should reignite the economy, for example, with a cut to stamp duty. I think there are things that we could do that would be authentically conservative, the right policies for the country, and would give us a better chance at the general election.
If, as Boris famously said, the ball were to come free from the ruck, would you be interested in becoming leader of the Conservative Party, if indeed there is a Conservative Party left to lead?
I've said before that I'm not going to rule it out, but it's not really about personalities right now. The most important thing is to understand the challenges that the country actually faces and to come up with some solutions to them that can help to win back those Conservative voters who understandably feel disillusioned and frustrated. And I hope that I'm contributing to that, not least on immigration, which, as I said, I think is by far the biggest issue upon which we could take serious action right now.
I was in conversation with some senior military people over the weekend, really, really worrying stuff about not having enough submarines, having carriers, but not having the frigates and so on to defend the carriers. You've said we should increase defence spending. Can you just give us a quick snapshot of that?
Well, I think the position is very worrying. We are living in an insecure world. The next 10 years will be incredibly important because in 10 years' time, it's perfectly possible that China will be the biggest military force in the world, that Russia will have rearmed. And we've got to use the years ahead wisely to rebuild our hollowed out armed forces. I do think we have to spend more. I think that Europe has to step up and take responsibility for its own defense, because the United States will look towards conflict with China and the Pacific in the years ahead, will ask us to take responsibility for our own defence.
Was President Trump right saying that certain NATO members weren't paying their way?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a question of fairness, that it's not fair that US taxpayers are paying for the defense of Europe. And there's also a question of capacity. And if the generational struggle that the United States faces is predominantly with China, it's going to have to use its finite resources for that. And so we in Europe will have to step up and take responsibility for our own defense, whether that being China with Iran and the freedom of navigation in the Red Sea, the other strategic issues that face us as a continent. I want to see the UK be a leading military power of Europe. That does mean that we're going to have to spend more money on defense. And so we're going to have to think carefully about how we do that. Above all, it means growing our economy and doing things like building more homes, welfare reform, planning reform, the things that will actually create a more dynamic economy for the UK. It means bearing down on waste elsewhere within government, spending money more wisely within the Ministry of Defence, and thinking of ways in which we can find the money that's necessary in the years ahead.
Well, let's end with a big shout out to Mrs. Jenrick doing the ironing. Robert, thank you very much. We're singing from the same hymn sheet, I think. So thank you so much. I'm sure listeners will really love listening to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very strong interview there, co-pilot, with one of the leading movers and shakers in the Conservative Party. He speaks very well. He knows what he's talking about. And he's quite courageous.
Listening to Robert Jenrick, for me, it's like having a long, cool glass of water when you've just come out of a major sandstorm. Think of the things he said, Liam. Multiculturalism has failed. We're having a pretend debate. I don't think the ECHR is reformable. It's an inhibitor to securing our borders. I don't want to see symbolic flights to Rwanda. They can't really be bringing in emergency legislation because their delays show they're fundamentally unserious. MPs too scared to speak up openly, shirking a very serious debate about Islamist extremism. The people in charge stuck two fingers up and betrayed the promise of Brexit. I mean, these are, by the standards of most contemporary politicians, this is very, very pungent, clear speaking. And I have to say, as a former Conservative voter, I really welcome it. And I think if Robert Jenrick or someone like him was leading the Conservative Party now, they would not be heading for an absolute obliterating defeat.
There have been two big stories this week, haven't there, that have fed into the immigration debate, again, in a pretty pungent way. We had Dame Sarah Khan's review. She's the government's independent advisor on social cohesion.
Yeah.
Into the situation with the school teacher in Batley, who remains in hiding because he showed us an illustration of the Prophet Muhammad as part of his teaching. Sarah Khan said that the teacher was totally and utterly failed and that harassment is a much wider problem in society and poses a serious threat to our democratic way of life.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, we've had the sense that Abdul Azizi completely mistreated, disregarded, made fun of our asylum system.
Absolutely.
He was admitted after his conversion to Christianity, said the judge. That weighed heavily on it, the judge who granted him asylum. He failed the Christianity test put forward by the Home Office, a very simple test on the basic facts of Christianity. And now he's had a Muslim burial and funeral. Unreal.
Yes, it really is. And I think we heard with Robert Jenrick just briefly describing what he encountered in the Home Office, how it opened his eyes to what is going on. I think we can all see it now, Liam, can't we? We're having rings run round us by cynical, exploitative people. And as we record Planet Normal today on Wednesday afternoon, the Home Office has just announced a record number of migrants crossed the channel in the first 3 months of 2024. The Home Office figure is 4,644 migrants. And the weather is only just starting to get better. So that is what the Conservative government, which promised Robert Jenrick and Suella Braverman emergency action in a total crisis, that's what they've delivered so far.
Now on to our listener emails. Your messages sent to planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk. Please keep them coming. We love to hear your thoughts, the citizens of Planet Normal.
Liam, we have had so much reaction to this VAT on private schools. We could fill an entire, in fact, we may well think about having, I think we might well have a whole podcast on this. It's fantastic. This is from Grant. My mother counted money at night for Securicore and had two cleaning jobs to send me to private school. For her, it was a choice, something aspirational. I had a fantastic school life and subsequently did well enough to send both of our children to private school. I was a bit entrepreneurial and my wife and I were prepared to give up things in order to do it. Over the 28 years of school for both kids at today's prices, we saved the state education system £215,320. I am at a loss as to why people think the so-called rich should be penalised with a 20% VAT hike. My pension has suffered as a result. I couldn't pay as much in as I'd like, but that was my choice for my kids. There seems to be an illogical, ideological jealousy out there. And Dee says, as a governor of a small private school with no reserves to absorb an increase in fees from VAT, we are having to take early steps to prepare. This is already involving staff redundancy, a recruitment freeze, a reduction in bursaries offered, an increase in fees, and stalling of staff pay increases. If pupil numbers drop by 10 to 15%, the whole school becomes unviable and will close. So not only will the 10 to 15% of pupils whose parents can't afford VAT be added to the local state school roll, so too will the extra 90% when the school closes. Who wins from that? Mindless. And I doubt Labour will show any favours to the grammars either. For decades, Labour have hated both grammar and private with equal prejudice. Just look at Scotland. An excellent state education system, totally destroyed by 20 years of levelling down and daft platitudes about excellence, sounds great in a local vacuum, but dismal when judged against international standards. The best becomes the worst. Just want to say to you, Dee, it's exactly the same story in my Wales, which once had a proud, world-beating education system, reduced to absolute rubbish by years of Labour misrule.
This from Marcus. Dear co-pilots, wow, what a pleasure it was listening to Martin Durkin talking pure articulate sense on our government's net zero high. He said it as I see it, and I shall be sure to watch his documentary, Climate the Movie, which is available now free on YouTube. If you just Google Martin Durkin, D-U-R-K-I-N, and Climate the Movie, you'll be able to watch it. I was in Port Talbot, says Marcus, last week, seeking out Tata employees at the steelworks and their thoughts, opinions and fears for the future. I was stunned to learn how ill-served our country is by its government and civil servants. The remaining two blast furnaces in South Wales producing high-grade steel are to be shut down with no smooth transition to a ready-built arc furnace, and that's an electric furnace to you and me. The arc furnace isn't built yet. Indeed, it hasn't even been planned for, and if it was built, it couldn't produce high-grade steel, the likes of which is used in the Challenger tanks, for example. This surely begs the question, does the government have an industrial strategy or want steel produced here? Well, even if they did, the grid in Port Talbot couldn't supply the power for such a plant. I could go on, as this self-made mess beggars belief. Is there a strategy for steel production in this country? You tell me. Meanwhile, the community in Port Talbot's being hung out to dry on the altar of net zero, which will change nothing. You think I'm wrong? Tata, who own the works, are building a larger blast furnace in India. When did common sense die in this country? Take care and please keep going. Your banter, humour, interviews and discussion remind me that there are people who don't just think of themselves, but want what's best for our islands. Regards, Marcus. Well, it tells us that Tata are using net zero as a bit of a fig leaf here in the UK, because clearly blast furnaces require coking coal, which is very carbon intensive, and they can make virgin steel, which is what Marcus is referring to when he says high quality steel. But we're going to be using in this country, not just in Port Talbot, but also in Scunthorpe. Port Talbot is owned by the Indians, Tata. Scunthorpe's owned by the Chinese state, effectively, and still works there. All those blast furnaces are going to be replaced by electric arc furnaces. And Marcus is completely right. It does put undue pressure on the national grid, the use of these electric arc furnaces. And we don't know how the national grid is going to handle it. So none of this seems thought through. And both you and I wrote about Port Talbot when the news emerged, didn't we? You wrote very movingly about, you know, your cousin who was working at the plant and now fears for the future of his family.
I went down to Port Talbot and spent the day there talking to workers, union officials.
You did a great report.
And we both felt this story very, very keenly, didn't we? I wrote about it in the Telegraph as well in order to try and explain that this wouldn't do anything for net zero to close down these blast furnaces in the UK. So it does strike me that none of this is thought through. It's just like our energy policy, our industrial strategy. There don't seem to be politicians or even journalists who really want to consistently get their head around this stuff, with some honourable exceptions in both our political and media class. But this is what should be dominating our news, these kind of issues. And yet we very rarely touch on them. So it's good that we can touch on them on Planet Normal, not least by tapping into the expertise of our listeners.
And finally, a couple of shorty shorts, Halligan, to tickle your fancy. Alexander, responding to the news of VAT on private schools, says, get with the Labour programme. Poverty for the many, not the few. Quite right. And Jane, I love this one. My label keeps getting bigger, says Jane. White privileged, unconsciously biased, now hated, Islamophobic, transphobic, and inherently racist. 10 years ago, I was considered to be a normal, nice, successful female that had achieved in life. Well, Jane and I have agreed, Liam, that we're going to have a special T-shirt printed with all of the terrible things that we are written on it. Citizens of Planet Normal, unfairly reviled. Well done, Jane.
And that's it from Planet Normal for another week. As we leave our sanctuary of sweet reason, our flying refuge of reason views, email of the week, it's the co-pilot.
I'd like to give it to Grant, who wrote so well about his mother counting money and cleaning just to send her boy to an excellent private school. You spoke for many, Grant. Well done. Can you send us your full name and your address?
To planetnormal@telegraph.co.uk and put in the subject heading, mug winner. And we will send you a Planet Normal mug.
If you enjoy Planet Normal, please do leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It does really help others to find us.
And as we speed away from our beloved Planet Normal and the madness of Planet Earth comes back into view, thanks as ever to our producers, Isabel Bouchard, Cass Ho and Louisa Wells. Stay safe and in touch with us and with each other. Until next week, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.